This is the London FinTech Podcast, brought to you by your host, Mike Ballaman, bridging the worlds of suits and t-shirts, of finance and technology, bringing you insights, stories, and inspiration from the golden age of opportunity and innovation happening in London right now.
Hi, this is Mike Ballaman, and this is the London FinTech Podcast, episode 246. Brought to you in association with Smart and enlistedboard.com. And I'm delighted to be joined today by Nick Lenz, non-executive, advisor and angel investor, to discuss the fascinating topic of the whole spectrum of netting, advising, mentoring, coaching and generally assisting startups and scale-ups. We'll discuss all those words later and what the categories might actually mean and whether they are really different. As the LFP aims to showcase for the benefit of the whole fintech community, what has been shown to work in terms of all aspects of both business and modern finance. Most of the founders and CEOs on the show that we speak to are very experienced and, as it were, have a full organogram of talents beneath them with which to create and amplify success. However, at the opposite end of the spectrum and for some time after, by definition, the day zero or the day one founder must personally only have limited commercial experience and know-how himself, even if he's super experienced in some area. No one has ever worked in every vertical of an FS organisation, in every box on an organogram, and therefore, day zero and day one, and for a few days after, has plenty of gaps in the armoury. Working with the assistance of the whole spectrum of mentors, advisors, coaches, NEDs, etc., can really accelerate the new founder, or the early founder, along the road to success. Nick has worked with many startups and scale-ups, and as myself, over the past 15 years or so, I've met one or two. So, plenty to talk about. Let's get on with the show. Good morning, Nick. Thank you for joining me on the show today.
Hi, Mike. It's an absolute pleasure. As you know, I've been a long-term listener of the show, and I'm delighted to be here.
Excellent. And I was just suddenly wondering whether you are a unique... Not, I hasten to add, the unique listener, as any people listening to this show will be yourself and maybe your mum. But I'm unique. I'm not quite sure whether you are or you aren't, but never mind. In that you have rather rare origins, shall we say, statistically speaking. Mind you, most of us have rare origins, statistically speaking, but yes, yours are rare.
Yeah, no, I guess I am somewhat rare in the sense that I was born and raised on a small island in the Netherlands. And then in my early teens, decided to exchange that very small island for a slightly larger island, being the British Isles. So the island is in the county of Friesland, where the Friesian cows are from. And the island is called Terschelling. It's one of the five Dutch islands. And it's a beautiful, beautiful place.
How big is it?
It's about a mile wide and about 15 miles long. So it's very thin and long. And it has about 5,000 inhabitants during winter and about 100,000 during summer.
Oh, so in Japanese terms, your Furusato is the island. Do you ever go back there annually like the Japanese do?
I do.
Or was your mum on holiday with your father when she gave birth and said, my son is now a Friesian?
My father wasn't actually from Friesland. He was from Amsterdam. But yeah, my family moved there and we had a wonderful time. And I do regularly go back. I love going there. Not necessarily just in the summer, it's a beautiful place to go.
And you move from there to, you say, the United Kingdom, not the disunited kingdom these days, but let's just say the British Isle, or whatever the main one, which is a little bit bigger. Where do you live?
London specifically, actually, yeah.
That must have been quite a change from a 1 mile by 15 mile island. Mind you, London's probably got a similar area, maybe 15 mile circumference or radius or something like that. But there's probably a few more than 5,000 people even when you came here.
It was a huge culture shock. I could just about speak English, as most Dutchies get taught English at a quite early age. But I wasn't quite prepared for all the other cultural differences, and particularly, you know, when I was 16, when I moved, changing schools and friends and, you know, the whole cultural aspect of living in a very busy city on my little bike cycling into school was quite an experience, shall we say.
I see. Well, maybe that helped you at an early age embody the idea of chaos and chaotic transitions, he says, trying to make a lead-in here. And then just in terms of the Netherlands, as you know, all us foreigners can never quite get it right. There's the Netherlands, there's the Holland, and there's all that sort of war of Spanish succession or whatever it was when you kicked them out and created Belgium and a whole bunch of other funny things happened over there. There's a couple of things which I was curious about. I think I should give up teasing Dutch people, although by now perhaps you feel you're Anglo-Dutch, about what is it specifically about the Dutch people. Maybe it's their accent, which all sounds rather harsh to the some ears, that led them to being the only people on the whole continent who were actually pushed out into the sea and therefore had to reclaim it. Off the top of my head, there's nowhere else on the whole coast of Europe where people got pushed into the sea. So maybe they pissed off quite a few people back in the day, but that one apart. The other thing is that when Queen Mary over here married William, who was the from Holland, and very important actually, because it led to the some of the capital market stuff from Netherlands coming here in terms of raising money and being able to beat up the French in wars, because we could borrow it and go and beat them up and then take the money off of them, which is quite a good business model. Sadly, it carries on to today, although it seems to carry on even if you lose wars today. But anyway, so that's what our history books say. But then I have seen or heard that in Dutch history books, they have, yeah, and then we took over England, you know, King William. So what was your understanding? You may not have done history at school.
No, history is definitely not my strong subject, but indeed, you know, the Dutch have been very present, shall we say, in other parts of the world and not necessarily left the best impression alongside many other European nations. But no, history is not my my chosen subject.
So you don't claim that you took over England and actually therefore you're just moving to what was a former colony of the Netherlands?
I certainly can't recall that from the history books that I read, no.
I've seriously seen that opinion actually. And of course, in reality, if one bothered to do a PhD in the whole subject, like many things, it would be definition. It wasn't a question that Mary just married some guy who just sort of was a house husband, and it wasn't a question that we sort of suddenly became assimilated into the Netherlands. But notwithstanding which, that of course the whole Anglo-Dutch, much more free markety, free tradey approach and capital markets approach has been very pivotal, and to this day, companies like Shell that are Anglo-Dutch. Right, so in terms of transitions, you transitioned at the age of 16 to become a landowner, as opposed to a Frisian. And at some point, you transitioned from big co to micro co, small co's, or whatever you want to call them. So maybe you'd be kind enough to let the listeners know about your career journey.
Yeah, so I started my career in London in investment banking, and I spent 20 years odd in investment banking and enjoyed that for the most part. I was lucky enough to be working with some fantastic people and managed to build a credible career. But ultimately, I had an entrepreneurial itch that I wanted to scratch. And that led me to leaving the world of big co, shall we say, in banking, and transitioning very much to the coalface of small co. So I wanted to do something that was much more exposed to the early stage startup ecosystem. So I took a giant leap of faith, as you, for lack of a better phrase, and left banking.
Which part of banking were you in? Which verticals? I mean, banking is a very big word.
Yeah, so I was on the fixed income side of the business, as I think you have a history in as well. But I was on the sales side of things. So I was advising large pension funds, predominantly in the Benelux, on their fixed income asset allocation and asset liability matching, as we like to call it. Yeah, having done that for 20-odd years, I thought there's got to be something a bit more challenging and interesting out there. And I always wanted to delve more into the kind of early stage ecosystem, what that meant. Actually, as a kid, I remember I started a number of small businesses. One of the first businesses was I bought beaten up old mopeds and then did them up and sold them on, hopefully for a profit, with a mate of mine. And then the next company I had, again, I was probably 10, 11 or something like that, was, this is pre-internet, of course, I started importing,
But not say cannabis on the podcast. Given your coffee shops over there, we didn't have those coffee shops over here, you may notice the last few decades.
No, I started selling merchandise for the biggest...
Merchandise
for the big sports and football teams in the Netherlands to the local community on the island. I had a couple of connections and so those were some early, I guess, ventures of my own. But coming back to why I left banking, yes, I wanted to do something more entrepreneurial. I wanted to have more impact, I guess, for lack of a better phrase. And I was lucky enough to be introduced to a fintech hub in London and was asked to mentor some of the startups in that hub.
Yeah, what are we talking about now, roughly?
So this would have been in 2017, and I started mentoring at that hub, and basically it was me meeting every founder I could and asking them, actually, what is it that you are struggling with? What is a real pain point that you are faced with? And, you know, might I have some perspective on those pain points?
Yes, and one of the things that, being modest enough not to mention, but I'll mention it for you, which is that both you and I are engaged inter alia in mentoring mentors these days. So mentoring people who are going to mentor people. And there's obviously a whole journey along that. And one of the things that's always a challenge is this moving from just to scribble something on the whiteboard, a square peg organisation, mega bank, where there's defined rules and all that, and going back to my even poorer than the average introduction to the world of not necessarily circles, because that's a regular thing, but sort of whatever the shape is, and adapting to whatever the shape is. And we haven't spoken about this, Bosni, but I'm sure you had the same experience in that if you mentor somebody who's been in mega bank, I've been in Megabank 30 years. I'm really important. I've got lots of experience. I have 5 million staff. I've got a huge salary. I can add lots of value to startups. Oh, good, good. That's great. Yeah. Right. So what about startups do you think you can have? Don't know. But yeah, no. I'm C-suite. I'm important.
No, that's a really interesting point. And absolutely, that transition for me from the big co and being an established entity, if you like, having worked in banks for 20-odd years, was a really tough journey. I literally had to redefine myself, my profile. You go from Nick Lenz investment banker to Nick Lenz, what exactly? And I'm a great believer in the fact that there is no better way of learning than by doing. So I threw myself in at the deep end, and I may not have had all the answers to start with, but, you know, at the end of those 2 years of mentoring and speaking to lots of different founders, I started to get a much better picture of what actually it is that they are struggling with and also what I could potentially contribute. But I think the key point for me here, Mike, is, and this also comes up in many of the mentoring conversations that I have with prospective non-executives, so people coming out of big corporates and wanting to become a non-exec, is the first step you need to take is take the perspective of the founder. Be humble. You know next to nothing about their startup. And so if you take that as a baseline perspective, that will set you up for success, or at least really being able to contribute to whatever it is they are trying to do.
Yes, and I think going back to my little caricature, which is pretty accurate actually, of the transition from being super important or at least super something in Megabank for a long time, I think the first part of the process, which is always humbling and interesting, is you might as well just leave your ego at your investment bank, because you ain't nobody's sonny anymore. And going back to the introduction where we were talking a little bit, I said, well, what do I call you, given that you do all these things? And you said, well, let's just use all the words. And like my sentiment, we can start defining the words in a minute. And I think that just finishing off on the transitioning from, before we move on to the adding value to, I always use the metaphor, which seems to go down quite well. It's generally blokes. I've mentored quite a few women as well. Which is that, well, let's say you're 13 or 14 or whatever age for the sake of argument, and you're a boy or a girl and you're at school and you like a boyfriend or a girlfriend, or 15 or 16 or 20 or 21 or 45 and 50, whatever. The first thing is, well, if you're a boy school like mine, you've got to actually find girls in the first place. And the same thing applies to potential mentors or potential NEDs, potential angels, but also to the actual founders. You need to be somewhere near, let's say you're going, you want to say, I want to go fishing, okay. And now I'll say to people, are you sitting near a river? No. Ah, okay. Point number one, sit next to a river. Point number two, do you know what bait the fish like? No. Okay, well, we'll try, you know. And actually, my metaphor has complete failure, as all metaphors always do, insofar as it's better with the boyfriend-girlfriend thing, which is, well, just forget about getting a boyfriend-girlfriend, just go and hang out with the opposite sex, as it were.
Yeah.
And so in this context, and I think it's probably best started perhaps before people transition out of Megaco, go and hang out with startups.
Yeah.
Just go to some events, just chat to them, and as you say, just ask the simple question, which is, yeah, so what are you guys up to? Yeah. What are your problems? What do you need? And then you start to understand the marketplace.
Yeah.
In an entrepreneurial sense. And you go, oh, the marketplace lacks Chinese white tea bags or something. Oh, I can do that. Or it doesn't have song and dance. I can do the song and dance. So yes, it's to find out the other side. So if that's leaving Megaco, the other thing you can do, of course, is sign up a program and be mentored on how to be a mentor by the likes of you and I, which in all seriousness is quite useful, even if it's just to have a one-hour private conversation about what a completely different world is like. I mean, I remember, actually very similar, I remember telling my kids when they left education system after whatever is better part of 20 years these days. I said, well, it's like you know a hell of a lot about living on Earth, but you're now going to go and live on Mars. You don't know anything.
Yeah.
No matter how clever you are, that was on Earth. You're now on Mars, so it's a different planet. So just dispensing with this organigrams, lines, boxes, and all this kind of stuff and language, because different people use it in different ways. We've got this whole thing about advising, mentoring, coaching, advisory director, non-executive director. How do you see all these words?
So that's a very good question, and I'm not sure I'll be able to fully answer it. But the way I experienced it is mentoring was the start of my journey. And that gave me a real grounded perspective of what founders, CEOs were really struggling with. And it also helped me, I guess, develop my skill set for being able to listen and being able to interpret what people were saying. And also being very honest on areas where I had absolutely no clue. Just to be clear, you're not necessarily imparting wisdom upon said founders at all. I think that's quite a common mistake that, you know, people coming out of big corporates tend to have. It's like, oh, let me tell you how the world works. Actually, it is much more about listening and then asking probing questions. And the power of constructive challenge, as I like to call it, is probably the most powerful tool, whether that be when you are mentoring, whether that be when you're advising a startup, or whether you are in a formal non-exec capacity. It's that ability to ask the right questions and to challenge founders as and when you feel they need to be challenged. So for me, the journey was, you know, mentoring what was the start of the journey. It turned out that I was reasonably good at that. And people that I had mentored then started asking me, Nick, we really like working with you. Would you be prepared to join us as an advisor, as a non-exec? So that then became an extension of what I was doing in the mentoring space. And, you know, I had already been angel investing for a good decade before that. So I started to get a really good kind of 360 view of that early stage ecosystem and what makes startups tick. And so that was kind of my journey, if you like. I'm not sure if I've answered the question, but...
No. It's you're explaining the organic experience, which is the only, quotes, real reality. And in that context, again, going back to just mentoring mentors, is that people from large organisations, sort of square pegs, organigrams and all that kind of thing, can end up with a very black and white view of things, like this is this and that is that, because it's all defined and it's grown up over centuries. And one of the problems with that, which is a complete no-no for me in any kind of mentor, advisor, coach, is to say, that can't be done. That's the biggest sin in my mind. You've got some crazy idea for, I don't know, importing Frisian Dutch people to London or whatever, merchandise. And I should never say, you can't do that. I might think it's not possible. I might think it's not, I can't see a route or whatever. But to the point about the challenging, perhaps, which is that Let's say you want to form a colony on Mars, having mentioned Mars. Okay, right, well, based on what little I know, that's a bit of a challenge. And maybe you need to build rockets first, which is what Musk's doing, you know. If you're really convinced that you can do it, hey, well, everything that's never been done in the world ends up being done at some point. So, okay, but the initial hurdle is going to be you haven't got a rocket. And your next hurdle is you've got to convince some people to sit on the rocket and, you know, really help people. I spoke a lot, for these people listen to it, in the New Year special this year, 2024, about the unknown. All startups, all founders are voyaging into the unknown, into unknown lands, into uncharted territory in old money. They need to explore it and that kind of thing. And if one is supporting such an adventurer, and back in the day, actually, in the 16th century, investors in early stage companies, or companies in general, they're all at early stage in those days, were called adventurers, which I think is much, much more relevant than shareholders, except you're an adventurer if you put money into a startup. They're on an adventure, and you, in a kind of paternalistic fashion, try and give them good advice as if it's your nephew or your niece. Hey, look, Johnny or Jane, whatever you do, look out for the tigers and look out for the rivers and give me a call, how are you going? But they are the ones in the unknown.
Absolutely, and I think, for me, starting a business is probably one of the hardest things one can do, right? So you've got to be either slightly mad or extremely stubborn / convinced about this idea that you have that you want to bring to life. And that's, I think, worth bearing in mind when you're speaking to founders. And to your earlier point, you know, who am I to say that your idea makes no sense? No, absolutely not. If you are a founder and you have a vision and you want to realize that vision, then as a good mentor, non-exec, advisor, whatever capacity you are supporting that founder, it is to start with the premise, okay, you have that vision, let me see and let me give you some perspective around how I might look at the problem or the challenge that you have. But most importantly, how can I help you get from A to B? And that really is, in essence, what I love doing. I love helping founders get from that very early stage. And I think in your book, Mike, about the power of the board, you discuss this where you are starting a fire and now you've started the fire. How do you grow the fire, right? So what ingredients does the business need to grow? And if I can help in some shape or form in that journey, that for me is in essence what that non-exec advisor position is all about.
Yes, you're trying to help people bring something into the world. And when you were talking about one of the craziest things you can do, I was briefly reflecting on the number of people who'd been crazy squared on the podcast in terms of creating a business and creating a family at the same time. They're hardcore, those people that do that. Right, okay, well, look, let's not worry about words like coaching. People tend to use coaching in one way, or the mentoring or advising and these sort of things. But picking up your point about the important thing being that the new co, the early co, the growth co, has a bunch of issues, has a bunch of challenges they need sorting today or more strategically over the next few weeks or the next few months. In terms of your experience with these businesses, and it's obviously a generalization, but it'll give a bit of a feel for the process. What have you found are really the core issues? And actually, as always, to make my questions go all over the place, before you do that, maybe you just want to share a little bit about how you use the vocabulary of, say, new co, a startup, a scale-up, a growth co. And then just come back to this, because obviously the core issues are going to be very different from your day zero founder, from your 3 years in founder who's just doing a B round.
Absolutely. So the issues facing startups change over time, as you will expect. The early stage founder, i.e. particularly first-time founders who've never been in that situation before, will often have deep domain expertise in the area that they're working in. They may have very good technical backgrounds, or they may have strong commercial backgrounds. But for example, many of them will have never raised equity for their own business. So, okay, how do I go about raising funds for my own business? Well, it's a process. and a process that requires a lot of homework, a lot of understanding of how that market works, what are the pools of capital that we can fish in. And so one of the earlier aspects of advising that I tend to get involved with early stage founders is very much around the fundraising piece. Now, if we then fast forward and, you know, you've raised a couple of rounds, you've got clients, you've got revenue, you've got traction, then the problem set shifts. And then it's all about, okay, how do we turn those, for example, early adopters, the early clients of the business, into mainstream? So how do we really grow and scale this business? How do we think about customer acquisition? How do we think about what the key ingredients are in terms of strategic hires that we need to make, and when do we need to make those? How do we think about building the right infrastructure for the business that allows it to grow? So the technology stack, the people in the business, also the funding piece. So the nature of the problems change, and this is why it's really important to always be in a position where you feel you can ask the dumb question, because there's no such thing, right?
I have some dumb questions, but that's another story entirely. Listeners know that.
The founder may have a particular perspective, but you are there to give an alternative perspective or to challenge him or her. And just to double click on that, for me, the advising role is all about cuddle and kick, right? So sometimes founders need support and they need an arm around the shoulder and they need someone to confide in.
Sounds like
in.
Sort of 14-year-old's dating experience, actually. How are you doing this week? This week's cuddle week.
This is cuddle week.
This week's been kicked week. What went wrong?
but sometimes, you know, founders need to be challenged, and that's a very healthy, I think, way to phrase that position of advising.
Excellent. Well, in the meantime, I thought of a... I don't know whether you have business cards. I don't have business cards anymore. I used to have when I started, actually. I've got some London FinTech Podcast business cards, probably selling for millions on eBay. Yeah. But I thought of a phrase, actually, which you could describe yourself were you ever to go back to the Stone Age, which might happen at this rate, given the desire of the negative elites. But if you had to have a business card, you could call yourself, and the genre in general, your CADA, Venture Accelerator.
Yeah, I like that.
Because it doesn't really matter whether you're formally, I'm a non-executive director, I'm a mentor, I'm a coach, I'm a whatever. You're really helping, and I'm very much thinking here of the would-be founders listening to the show, or people who may not think of themselves as a would-be founder, but in 10 years' time they go, oh, gosh, I'm a founder after all, silly me. At least I'll have some fun. That in terms of finding these people with grey hair or no hair, which just occurs to me, actually, is a genderist phrase, but if you're actually looking for somebody who's sort of quite more senior than a founder, then generally they were the kind of people who used to be the only people who did business decades ago. Yeah, seeing it from the perspective of the founder, whether you're founding today, whether you founded yesterday, or whether you found tomorrow, I think a nice way of summing this all up, which if I scratch my head a bit more, writing the blindingly confusing introduction... Yes, I might have said, well, actually, from their perspective, try two or three venture accelerator folks. See whether they help accelerate you. And if they accelerate you, keep them around and maybe bring them on board, literally, at some point.
No, that's an excellent point, Mike. And in fact, one of the things that I wanted to highlight in today's conversation is also having good advisors as part of your startup journey can be absolutely transformational. Right, I'm not just saying that, but genuinely I've seen it happen. And an extension of that is founders typically think about the board construct as this very kind of nebulous, abstract thing. But actually, when you think about it, if you are a founder and you're always resource constrained, that's the nature of early stage businesses, whether that's funding or people or otherwise, having a board is an incredible way to get real heavy-hitting talent into your business that can help you accelerate the growth of the company. And this, you know, when we talk about boards, this is the way I like to phrase the conversation with founders, is don't think of the board as, you know, some things that are going to constrain your growth, or I should have one because I'm coming up to a Series A round and I've got to look grown up, so to speak. No, think about a board as an incredible opportunity for you to accelerate the growth of the company and get some amazing people to be part of your journey.
Absolutely. I think there's a good book on Amazon about that, actually, which I know you've read. So, and that's the Rosie scenario. I mean, just finishing off from the perspective of the venture accelerator person, reality being what it is, it ain't always simple. And having spoken before about early dating and mating experiences, or early dating and frustration and lack of mating experiences, there are the same frustrations decades later when you're being a venture accelerator. And the two practical challenges that many people face from one side of the table, which ends up being a headache for the other side of the table, of course, is the exploitation. Many people start off in the early stages and they're bound to have this experience. I mean, I remember decades ago someone telling me about this. They were transitioned from big co to small co, and I'm thinking about 20 years ago, and they went somewhere and they helped as much as they could. Helped a hell of a lot. Didn't monetize it, didn't really get paid. And life was a bit less PC 20 years ago. And I said, what was it like? He said, well, it was like having my Rolodex raped. And then one day they said, well, we've introduced us to all the people, you know, thanks. And not monetizing. So the whole thing in terms of interpersonal relationships, and it is interpersonal, and people tend to forget that in tech companies when it's about computers. Well, actually, the computers won't do anything on their own, not yet anyway, without the human being. So everything is relational between two human beings. So nobody, I think, can have gone into this whole field, this whole territory, from the venture accelerator side, without having been exploited. I'm here to help, and I'll accept nothing. So what's your practical experience with ensuring that, hey, I'm here to help? You know, you can stand in the middle of London with your wallet open. Anybody want any money? Anybody want my time? I'll come wash your car for you, or whatever. Funnily enough, if you sell something valuable for nothing, then you're going to generate infinite demand. So at some point, everybody goes to another painful transition, which is, oh, going around being Mr. Nice Guy or Mrs. Nice Woman, Ms. Nice Woman. That's not an ideal business model for me.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And again, through lived experience, I've gone through at least a cycle of exactly that. But my learnings from that are, be very intentional, be very clear around when you're having conversation with founders or startups about what it is that you will contribute to their particular journey and over what time frame. If that is initially on a pro bono basis, that's fine. But be very clear around, you know, if this mating and dating works and actually we happen to get on with each other really, really well, and I see value in what you bring to the table, let's then sit around the table and discuss how we can formalize that. So any mentoring engagement that I have, or initial kind of pro bono engagement that I have with a founder, I'm very clear around, okay, you know, I can do this for 3 months or 6 months, whatever it is. But at that point, if we think there is a, you know, value between what I bring to the conversation and what the founder needs as part of him or her growing the business, let's then sit down and formalize this. And, you know, unsurprisingly, with early stage companies who are cash poor, that initially tends to be in the form of equity. So you will get paid in equity for your services.
Or even in terms of potential equity from a raise or potential funds.
Or absolutely. You know, if you're doing some advisory work specifically around a fundraise, then you may say, you know what, if you and I, as your advisor in this process, are successful in raising these funds, then, you know, compensate me in the form of equity as part of the fundraise. So, yeah, that clarity, intentionality, and alignment of interest, if you like, is really, really important. Also, we mustn't forget the flip side of the coin is that there are an awful lot of folks out there, unfortunately, that are perhaps not always, don't always have the best interest of the company at heart. And that's another reason why I went into this.
Why? Because you didn't have it as a heart. You want to rethink that one, actually, in your marketing material.
No, it's just to give some clarity to and some honesty into that early stage kind of funding world, where there is a lot of, you know, uncertainty and, you know, some less than dubious characters. So, yeah, I hope to give some clarity to that.
Yes, it works on both sides. And you know, to your point, from the perspective of the founder, the CEO of the business, and I do have something on enlistedboard.com. There's a slide share about the role of advisory boards. Some people interpersonally are exploitative, 1% are narcissists or psychopaths or sociopaths or whatever. So nothing can be done about this if they're not seeing it that way. But the more intrapersonally exploitative you are, that's going to affect the brand at some point. I mean, even in London, you say it's a big place, but the community of people involved in this kind of thing is relatively small. So you have to be careful of the world going around. But equally, you can be aware that there are more creative solutions to remuneration that don't involve putting your hand in the pocket for precious cash when you don't have some. And equally, again, going back to the whole sort of spectrum of how far you are from day zero to day infinity, it's very different for a business who's pre-seed, pre-friends and family, pre-A or pre-B or pre-C or pre-D. So it very much changes along that spectrum. Right, okay, so look, we've had a very organic conversation. It's a good job it's not a university lecturer for an exam, as it'd be hard to turn it into bullet points. But I think that's in itself maybe one of the largest things here for people to know that haven't been in this area, which is that depending on how early it is, it's not very defined and these things can blur. And in terms of the journey, as you say, for the venture accelerator, they will go through these periods where they get exploited and then they learn to either productize themselves or do a mini consultancy sell. Look, you know, I'll do 4 weeks with you on the raise and, you know, for this creative approach. And equally from the other side, for the founder, as I'm evangelical about in terms of the book, as you say, that you can gain a hell of a lot. Actually, I'll use the word wisdom. We can all use these words different ways. You can gain a lot of wisdom, commercial experience, and know-how if you leverage the whole community of mentors, advisors, venture accelerators, NEDs, angels. And that can literally mean the difference between success and failure. So it's absolutely crucial. And again, as I emphasise in the book, and as you've touched on, one of the most important points is that there are some amazing business persons out there who are never, ever going to work for you. But they might pop in a day a week, they might pop in for a week or here or there, if they're really interested in the vision. And from the founder's perspective, you need to sell a vision, and you need to have some coherent story about how you're going to achieve it, whether you are trying to attract advisors or mentors or NIDs, or whether you are going to attract funds. It is a sales story. It is a seduction story. Why should any of these people go out with you or give you their money, which is even more expensive, although in some circumstances those two overlap. Anyway, getting away from the mating, dating thing, how would you like to pull all this together, Nick? I think you've done a very good job of explaining and giving people a feel of what it's like organically and giving people a feel that these things are relationships, and as well, relationships, there's a million and one relationships. If we ask the next 100 people we meet today, or walk past in the street today, what's your relationship like? They're never going to be the same. But importantly, people will hopefully aim to get the kind of relationship they need. So what would you say to your younger self before they were about to leave Bigco, other than you must be mad, or you should have done it 10 years earlier or something?
Yeah, definitely the latter in my case. But no, in all seriousness, for me, if you enjoy and get a kick out of helping other people, because like you said, that's what it's all about ultimately. You're helping folks and their businesses become bigger, become stronger. If you help or enjoy that process and you enjoy watching a company grow and understanding what makes a company go faster, then I think working in this area, in whatever capacity it may be, is extraordinarily rewarding, and not necessarily in monetary terms, but in terms of being able to contribute to that very early stage of this embryonic thing that is SmallCo, for me is the most exciting thing in a professional capacity that I can do.
Yes, and I think it's a nice note to wrap up in. Just like a family, you're intimately involved in creating something that never existed before, and that's pretty much top of the shop if you're old school, talking when you were younger, if you're old school Christian European-y, well, that's what God did at the beginning of the Bible, so he must have thought it was fun, and we can do smaller versions of that. So before we wrap up the show, I'd like to thank all listeners out there, my brand partners of the podcast, Smartest, transforming pensions and retirement worldwide, the leading edge retirement tech platform, propelled them success in the UK. Now they're operating on four continents and working with partners like Zurich and JP Morgan. Find out more at www.smart.co. listboard.com, your guide to entrepreneurial governance and how you can start making your board an engine of growth today. So, Nick, maybe you'd like to give the listeners a few personal shout-outs for you, wearing your various subcategories of Venture Accelerator hat. And one of the things you haven't mentioned is that although we're on a fintech podcast today, albeit in the 40%, I think, of episodes-ish that are on entrepreneurialism per se and therefore of more general application. But in terms of sectors, you don't just work in the FS sector. So maybe you'd like to do the shout-outs and tell the listeners which sectors you're particularly involved in.
Yeah, so as you said, I initially spent my early years in the early stage ecosystem very much in fintech, as that was a natural extension of my finance career. But over the last 4 or 5 years, I've become much more involved in the clean technology space. And I'm finding that extraordinarily interesting. I'm learning an awful lot. And actually, it reminds me of fintech probably a decade or so ago.
When you say clean tech, you're not talking about washing machines and dry cleaning.
Sorry, no, I should be more specific. Anything that has some kind of positive climate impact in whatever shape or form that might be. But there is an awful lot going on in that particular space. And there's some really exciting founders and companies being established. And as I said, it reminds me of where fintech was maybe a decade or so ago. In terms of shout-outs, two types of people that I'd love to have a conversation with. One is any founders that are looking for advisors or non-execs or that are thinking about how they compose a board and board composition. I'd love to have conversations with those folk. And the second is any individuals listening to the podcast that maybe are currently working in a large corporate but are exploring the idea of perhaps doing non-exec work. Again, I'd love to hear from them as well. I do a lot of mentoring on that side. You can find me on LinkedIn, Nick without a K, Lens.
With a Z.
With a Z. Thank you, Mike. Likewise, on the platform formerly known as Twitter, I'm Nick, N-I-C, Lens, L-E-N-Z.
Excellent. Yes. I was thinking, walking here this morning, actually, talking of the platform formerly known as Twitter, X, is that if you go back, go back to 2020, you'd actually have to spend a bit of time trying to find out what's going on in the world and actually a bit of thought. These days, you just go to X and literally just follow Elon Musk. You don't have to follow anyone else. And probably RFK Jr. if you want to do a bit more sophisticated. And you could learn about all sorts of things going on in the world. And just in terms of the clean tech, as I mentioned to you, I did on the way here, walk past the Department of Energy, which is now called Department of Energy Net Zero and Climate something or other. Anyway, whatever, which is that it's very possible, and I do this quite well, to be extremely cynical, to put it mildly, about that. However, and I may have told the story by my next-door neighbour, their daughter got into this whole field. However, going back to the fact that entrepreneurs and founders have to create things that don't exist, we absolutely don't have, on a 1,000-year view, sustainable energy sources. Whatever we think about 2030 or bullshit like that, it doesn't really matter that whatever resources we have will run out. And it's only founders, literally entrepreneurs, that at some stage, maybe today, maybe tomorrow, maybe a century from now, will create the thing which is going to replace it all. So there's plenty of opportunity to be done. There's plenty of problems out there in the world. And just picking up your point, I've known you for some time now. And whether it's Nick, whether it's me, whether it's other people, I've seen people gain real benefit, literally, just by having a 1-hour conversation. You know, we're not the kind of people who are going to try and sign up people for 12 months mentoring and coaching and all that kind of stuff. But it is about this whole thing about moving into a new territory that you haven't been before. Before you moved to London, if you'd spent an hour speaking to somebody who'd done the same thing as you 20 years beforehand, that would have been a bit of a useful heads up about what to do and what not to do. And perhaps you would have spent many fewer years walking around London in clogs, because you would have spotted that people could see you from out of. So thank you very much for that, Nick. It's been really helpful. I hope it's been interesting for the people out there who are in Big Co, who are thinking about investing, advising, mentoring, all those kind of things. And equally, I hope it's been part of my evangelical crusade to persuade founders that, yes, you need money to grow your business, especially in the modern tech world, but you've always needed money to grow your business. Money isn't the only thing you need. There's a hell of a lot of other stuff to come, and there are lots of people out there who do it, and I would wholeheartedly recommend Nick. So thank you very much for that, Nick, and I wish you every success in the future.
Thank you very much, Mike. It's all about the conversation, and thanks for today. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening. If you're in need of a non-executive or advisory director with deep expertise, experience, and contacts in the worlds of both traditional FS and fintech, or unique insight into how to make your board an engine of growth today, contact me at mike@mikeballyman.com. If you just need one-off advice in these areas, via clarity.fm/mikeballyman.
We could sit in a bender all day, watching the firelight dance, watching the firelight dance. We could walk in the mountains before dawn, watching a happy moon ride, watching a happy moon ride. To come away from the city, the tarmac so dead and the people so sad. Come away from the city, but with the faces so gray, with the pain of the everyday. The mountains and the trees. Can you see what I mean? Can you see what I mean? We fit in between the earth and the sky. Kiss the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. Wave the city goodbye. City goodbye. Watch the firelight dance with me. 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 Watch the firelight.